Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring podcasts on the Blue Wire Network. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System yet, then you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. Wherever you are across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's Unified, U-N-I-F-Y-D, healing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.
What's up, y'all? It's Drewski, and I've teamed up with Mountain Dew to produce a hilarious new basketball podcast called The Dew Zone with Drewski. Learn the backstories of your favorite ballers and celebrities like Jamal Murray.
Did you have, like, a favorite team? Was it the Raptors at the time or no? Was the Raptors even started around that time?
Come on, bro.
I ain't that old, fam. You're talking like I'm 50.
Taylor Rooks, Asia Wilson, and many more. You won't want to miss this. Listen to The Dew Zone with Drewski on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
And welcome to In the Know, the Hornets 24/7 podcast. Your knowledgeable hosts are Michael McNamara.
Me and a grizzly bear, I'm betting on me.
And me, Ryan Schwan.
I've been playing some Dungeons & Dragons because I'm really cool like that.
Let's get it started. All Hornets, all the time.
Welcome to the show. Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, whatever you maybe enjoying at this time. The Hornets just lost two more games since our last podcast. This is kind of like a repeat thing. I should probably just record this opening every single time and replay it for you. They lost both of these games, the one to San Antonio, the second one to Indiana, and I don't know, a heartbreaker that people took pretty hard in the comments section of Hornets 24/7. But before we get to Indiana, let's talk San Antonio, where the Hornets in the end only lost by 5. Was that game that close, Michael?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think the Hornets did a good job of crashing the offensive glass. You know, they had some opportunities in that game. It seems like every time they got close, Tony Parker just put it on his shoulders and, you know, had a wide array of floaters and nice little jumpers. And he's just a guy that, frankly, there's nobody on this team that could cover him. And whenever he wanted to go, wherever he wanted to go, he got there. He's a guy who hit the game-winning shot that beat us in the season opener and basically beat us in this game as well. But after some, you know, blowout losses, it was somewhat encouraging to stay this close to one of the elite teams in the Western Conference.
It was promising, especially since the Hornets did not shoot particularly well, especially from deep. They were 2 of 16 for the game. They only got 16 free throws. I mean, there was a lot going against them in that game. But I think one of the major takeaways I have from this is just San Antonio's defense is not what it was. I thought Danny Green was doing a fine job out there, but the rest of their team was not particularly fantastic. And I also took away from this game that Anthony Davis, we've made comparisons of him to Tim Duncan. He's a long way from Tim Duncan. Despite him having a nice game, he's a long way from Tim Duncan at this point.
I agree, but I'd still like to see 19-year-old Anthony Davis against 19-year-old Tim Duncan. But yeah, I agree. Duncan looks recharged. I mean, he's had some of his best dunks of his career this year. He's flying all over the place, looks great. And as far as San Antonio's defense, I mean, they've made a couple of conscious swaps to bring in more offensive-minded players. I mean, Boris Diaw can't cover anybody. Steven Jackson was once you know, a really good defender, especially on specific players, like stretch fours like Dirk, and he's lost a step. You also got to remember Kawhi Leonard. This was his first game back, so he's just kind of working into it. I still think this is a team that's going to be really, really dangerous when it comes playoff time, especially if they could get Ginobili to look anything like his former self, which I felt like in this game he didn't, save for one drive when he kind of he used the Euro step, took the drive to the basket, and tried to dunk over Anthony Davis.
Yep, and Anthony got him. Got a foul, but he got him. I was pleased by that. Of course, Sean Elliott, the wonderful, completely unbiased color guy for the Spurs, is acting like he actually dunked. But, you know, it was. I was very glad Anthony Davis didn't end up on a poster.
Hey, don't pick on Sean Elliott. He was actually very nice about Austin Rivers this game. And
I couldn't figure that out. So I'm like, early on, he was semi-trashing Anthony Davis. He had some unpleasant things to say about Davis, and then next thing I know, he's like acting like Austin Rivers is, you know, the second coming of Kobe Bryant. It was he's like, oh, he's so athletic and long and explosive, and oh, he's gonna start making that shot soon. He just has to keep working. It made me think that maybe Sean Elliott and Doc Rivers are like friends. And that's the only thing I could think of. There's no other reason for him to be doing that. Yeah. It was weird.
I think perimeter players appreciate perimeter players. And I think that, you know, even in this game, he goes 2-for-8, doesn't have by any means, his greatest game, but he was getting to where he wanted to get on the court. His floaters, a couple of them rattled in and out. And I just think it's a thing where it's probably that, if you're not in New Orleans or a Hornets fan, the only time you hear about Austin Rivers is when you read one of these national media articles about how big of a disappointment he is. Then you see him in person and you see him, you know, getting around guys at will and, you know, with some craftiness to his game. So I think it's surprising where Anthony Davis, you know, your expectations are so high that if he doesn't come out and go for 25 and 12, you're disappointed.
Yeah. So he had 38 minutes this game. He had 18 points, 11 rebounds. I mean, so both in this game and in the Pacers game, we have a really high expectations for Anthony Davis. We've talked about him potentially being, you know, a top 50 player and everything. Would you even put him in the top 50 right now?
That's so weird. I was thinking about that exact question today as my wife was making me wash the dishes. And I wouldn't, because I don't know if I would put David West there, but if I had one game to win, I'm definitely taking guys like David West, Tim Duncan, Kevin Garnett, guys who are definitely on the backside of their career. You know, I would still take them over Davis if I had one game to win. So I guess it's, you know, what am I talking about? Am I talking about a full season? We're talking about the future, you know, maybe that then I would put him in the top 50. But if we're talking about just to win one game tonight, he's just so frail at this point that, you know, he could be pushed. I mean, he's getting pushed out of bounds on offense. He's running the baseline and he's so weak that he's just having to stand out of bounds so the opponents don't touch him and push him around. And then on defense, you know, it's the same thing where he's just getting bodied up. So he's got about 10 to 15 pounds of muscle to put on before he gets into that conversation of top 40 or 50 players.
Yeah, I mean, he is on offense very limited in what he can do when it comes to fighting for position. I think he's actually being really smart about it. The way he counters that is he slips baseline, he works side to side under the basket to get open for those dunks, and he's actually very quick on his release. If somebody is going to challenge him, he puts it up as fast as possible. He's also diving down the middle where he can't be impeded and he's not fighting for position. He's doing what he can with what he has right now, and he's got enough touch and enough leaping skill that he's still an effective player. But you're right, until he can battle more effectively down low with these guys, he's going to have trouble. And that's not something you can do really during a season.
Yeah.
So we're probably looking at two off seasons honestly, I don't think he can even do it in one offseason. I think we're looking at it in two offseasons before he's to the point where he's not physically overmatched by, you know, half the players in the league, at least.
Right. And I mean, it's just, again, to put it into context, though, 19-year-old Tyson Chandler couldn't get playing time in this league.
Right.
I mean, he was both frail and, you know, lacked skill. And Anthony Davis, there's some weight and some, you know, little basketball IQ things he's going to have to pick up before he's an elite player. But, I mean, he is an above-average starter in this league without question. And he's in, you know, the first 20 games of his NBA career. So I'm not worried at all. But, you know, it was frustrating a little bit this week to see David West and Tim Duncan kind of push him around.
All right. So I want to get what your impression is. I went and looked up some stats. When Anthony Davis takes that set shot from about, you know, 18 feet, 19 feet, are you happy when he does that? Do you think that's in his game right now?
I'm kind of happy that he takes it, but I wish that he had something else to play off it. So when I teach my kids basketball moves, I teach them a standard move, a counter to that move, and then a counter to the counter. So if Anthony Davis just has that jumper, but he doesn't have the ability to pump fake and put it on the ground or to get a guy up in the air and lean in and draw the foul, then he's a very easy guy to cover. I guess I don't mind him taking that shot if teams start to expect it and he could pump fake and put it on the ground, but he's not doing that. He's just, to me, if I'm an opposing coach, I look at him and I go, that's an incredibly easy guy to cover. He's only going to do one of, you know, two things on the court. So I don't mind him taking the jumper, but he's got to develop some counters or some ways to play off that shot when people start running at him.
Yeah. I mean, when I see it, and my problem is sometimes when he misses, it's missing to the so badly that you feel like maybe he's not a shooter. Because, you know, like when Ryan Anderson misses, it's short or long. It's never offline. He's almost always hit, you know, shooting, and it has a really good chance of going in if he has the right amount of power and enough leg in it. But, I mean, Anthony Davis will miss wide left, wide right. It's like Lance Stephenson in that Pacers game where the ball, I mean, it wasn't even coming in, and it wasn't even the right direction. It was pretty bad. So I went and took a look. I just wanted to see, is my feeling being overly impacted by the fact that sometimes he misses that badly? And I mean, I am being a little bit stupid about it. So an average power forward and center in this league shoots that 16 to 23 foot jump shot at 38%. And Anthony Davis is shooting at 37%. And he takes 2.7 a game. Which is, it doesn't sound like a lot. If you're only taking two or three shots a game, it doesn't sound like a lot. But the average power forward or center shoots only 1.5 of them. So he's taking more than the regular power forward, and he's only slightly below the average in the league. Now, if you're taking 2.7 a game, you'd want the guy to be hitting better than the average. But it's not like a disaster. I mean, there are guys in this league, of course, who are taking quite a few of those shots and, you know, can't hit them to save their lives, like Josh Smith, for one. But I don't know. I wanted to get your impression of that shot and whether you think it was good or not. And my original feelings were pretty ambivalent towards it, but yeah. I think I need to relax a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, we got reminded in that Pacers game, and we remember that when David West first came to the Hornets, he always, you know, would show and go on that jumper, and you know, the Hornets staff would just have to tell him, no, take that jumper. That's an efficient shot for you. But he was kind of afraid to pull the trigger on that for the first couple of years. And, I mean, I guess if I'm looking at this as a long process, I'm glad that he has the confidence to take that shot. And secondly, that shot because he has such a high release and he's so long, that's almost an unblockable shot. You know,
yeah.
So once he gets that going, that's going to be a weapon that's going to be incredibly hard to stop, because I can't see anybody getting to that shot.
Yeah. Yeah, that's if you expect him to get better at that particular shot. Honestly, I would be hoping for him to be working on other things to add to his game first, but, you know, I thought I would bring it up because I do see that shot a lot, and the basketball purist to me says, "Wow, you're taking it," and then I realize he's not that awful. I mean, he's not shooting it as badly as Austin Rivers is.
There you go, always a bright side.
That's right. Our other rookie sucks at that, so go Anthony. All right, so now we got to go to the part of the podcast where you apologize.
Uh-oh.
So you've been murdering Robin Lopez for weeks, and he puts together two pretty strong games.
Yeah, that's all we need. Put him on.
So are you going to apologize to Robin Lopez because he had two strong games?
No, I don't know where this idea of apologizing to people coming. I mean, I just give my critique, of what I see. But no, I mean, this was a follow-up to the Clippers game, which, you know, again, statistically was strong. But, you know, Lopez did what he needed to do in the 25 minutes in this game. He crashed the boards, which, you know, San Antonio just kind of gave up on the offensive boards. They're such an efficient team on offense that they don't even try to grab offensive rebounds. They just kind of get back. So he was decent, I would say, on the boards this game, and a couple of nice shots. But again, that my thing is never that has anything to do with him being a bad player. It simply is that this team is so desperately needs guards that Lopez is one of the only, you know, tradable assets, and I would move him. I mean, it's
all right. Yeah, so you brought up the San Antonio thing. I actually read a scouting report of the San Antonio Spurs, and I found it fascinating how they deal with offensive rebounds. Apparently their philosophy is if it's a guard who's driving to the basket and takes a shot, it's that guard's job to try to get an offensive rebound if possible, and everybody else runs back. And if it's a jump shot, the center, or it's their job to try to get an offensive rebound, and everybody else runs back. So they only – and if it's a guard driving, that means the center's job is to run back on defense. He's not supposed to even try to get an offensive rebound. So it's pretty much they send one person, and usually because they get a lot of penetration with their guards, it's one of the smaller people on the floor, to try to get an offensive rebound, and that's it. That's fascinating to me because, I mean, offensive rebounds are supposed to be like the genesis of easy points. You get an offensive rebound, you get a putback. It's great stuff. And the Spurs are just like, forget it. And they have one of the most efficient offenses in the game. And it's not just this year. Last year they did the same sort of thing on for offensive rebounds. And they were the best offense in the league last year. So it's I just think it's really fascinating how different teams can be to get the same sort of results.
Yeah, I mean, you would send people to the glass if you needed extra possessions to win, but I think the Spurs' philosophy is if you and I get the same possessions, the same number of possessions, we're going to beat you. So, I don't know. I mean, in this game, the Hornets hit the offensive glass, but the Spurs were just so much more efficient in their offense that they were able to pull away. And honestly, the thing that really got me is sometimes you question, you know, are the Hornets over dribbling? You know, or am I just biased against certain players and I'm watching too much? And then you watch the Spurs play and you watch that ball just move crisply across the court and on the perimeter and inside, outside. And you, when you watch a team like that, you realize that, yes, your offense is bad. Even though every once in a while a couple of players will have a standout game, you know, the ball movement and spacing on this Hornets team is just horrible compared to what the Spurs do.
Yeah, and you know what, actually, you mentioned that, but what upset me the most about the Hornets in this game, and even in the Pacers game, is if you go and you watch that San Antonio Spurs game, when the ball swings to a guard, and it's not supposed to continue around the perimeter, like the offense is set up in such a way that that guard is the last person to receive it, they don't hesitate when they catch it. They catch it, and either the ball is going to be shot, or they make a move immediately. They dribble to the left if it's swinging that direction, or to the right if it's swinging that direction, so that the defense never gets any sort of rest. They move immediately, and even if they get cut off, then they'll back up and reset. But you watch the Hornets, and the ball swings, and it lands in a guard's hands. They'll run sets. They'll run sets that are specifically designed where one guard gets penetration. If he's cut off, he kicks it out, which gets reversed to another guard, and that guard is then supposed to take their turn attacking. But when that ball hits that second guard's hands, or even the small forward's hands, everything stops. That guard stands there. They don't move. They don't attack either way. They kind of survey the court, and that lets the defense catch up. And you don't get that. I mean, like I think I said this before, the entire premise for most offenses is you keep a defense scrambling until you gain a second on them. And when you have that 1 second, that's enough for you to get a shot off. And if you stop and survey at any point, you've allowed them to reset. They're back in there. So maybe you have a mismatch, but at least they're still set. And they're going to be able to run people at you if they need to. And half the time we end up just like Brian Roberts will get the ball at the top or Vasquez will get the ball at the top. And instead of going forwards, they'll back up. And I think David Wesley said it during the Pacers game where he's like, you know, this team just spends too much time going backwards where they catch the ball, then they back up to get room to attack. That bothers me. I mean, even if it ended up resulting in a few more turnovers, if our guys could catch and go, I would feel so much better.
Yeah, I mean, and that's what I'm saying is when we were talking about if Aminu could be a starter on this team, or I think that the Hornets are more players away than fans like to admit as far as, you know, what needs to fix this offense, because that San Antonio game, I mean, they don't have stars on that team. Danny Granger's not a star. Gary Neal's not a star. But they have guys who could do multiple things and, you know how to make the right basketball play. And I guess a somewhat encouraging thing, I feel like we're going to kind of trick ourselves into somewhat believing again. But this week we've actually seen Xavier Henry play two somewhat decent games at the small forward position. I mean, is there anything there that he could be a serviceable guy, or at least wrestle this position away from, you know, the four guys kind of jockeying for it and hold on to it for the rest of the year?
No. I mean, I'd love that to be the case. I mean, Xavier Henry appears to have all the tools, but I don't think he actually does have them. And I don't know, Xavier Henry, if he keeps attacking, he's okay. But I mean, just you look at like the Pacers game, he'll have like almost clean looking layups and he'll find some way to botch them. There isn't any natural ability there. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, but there at least is a complementary ability to who these Hornets would be theoretically with all their players on the court. I mean, at least, you know, he has some kind of perimeter touch from time to time that, you know, if and when Gordon does come back or the Hornets could get that ball movement going, a little bit of flow on offense, at least he has somewhat complementary skill.
Yeah, I mean, at least he can dribble the ball and it won't go off his foot. I agree.
Yeah, I mean, it's remarkable. It's a little spoiler alert for those who are going to read our Hornets beat tomorrow. Joe comes up with the questions, and he asked who the best small forward on this team is right now. And that's such a depressing question because we have four and they're all pretty much bottom of the barrel small forwards in this league. I mean, you just wish that they could get one.
Yeah, they're all replacement level. And I mean, you're talking about Xavier Henry maybe, you know, taking the reins here, but I'm still in Lance Thomas's court at the moment, and he can't dribble, but I mean, at least he is all over the court. I mean, I'll give him that. He's all over the court. He doesn't have an offensive game, but defensively his rotations are sharp and he's energetic and trying to do everything he can out there. And Xavier Henry, I don't want to smash him because I think Xavier Henry is legitimately trying. I just think Lance Thomas is a little bit better at certain things.
Well,
which is bad.
I might shock you here, but I think you might have stumbled on something about a week ago with a question that you asked that was somewhat of a joke, but I think might be the answer. When you asked if Grievous Vasquez could be the small forward on this team, because I'm putting together a piece with Mason, you know, kind of going through the numbers and what to expect if, you know, Eric Gordon comes back 100% and what that might mean for this team. And, you know, Vasquez's numbers, he's played, some minutes this year at the small forward position, at least the biggest guy in a three guard lineup. And his PER is the highest at that position. His turnover rate is drastically low. His assist rate is still pretty high. I think that could be a solution at the very least for at the end of games. I feel that if Gordon comes back, the end of games are going to be Gordon with Vasquez at small forward and either Rivers or Mason as the other guard. And I really wouldn't be surprised if, you know, whoever you want to call the small forward, but that's more of what we see when Eric Gordon comes back.
Yeah. I was joking when I said it, but I in some ways I wasn't, because as far as rebounders go, as long as it's not Aminu start at the small forward, he's better than any other wing player we have as a rebounder. So putting him at the small forward is going to help us, him being able to move the ball. And, you know, his speed issues aren't as dramatically exposed when you're going against a small forward. Now, will he be able to defend some of the bigger small forwards? Probably not. But, you know, at least there's very few powerhouse small forwards in league. Like, LeBron James, Andre Iguodala, Kevin Durant, you're not stopping those guys anyways.
Right.
So put Vasquez where, you know, maybe he'll help out against the lesser lights in the league and get yourself a few more wins, if that's what you want.
Yeah.
So here's the question for you, and that's a great way for me to leap. Gordon's coming in this week. Do you want more wins?
I not only want more wins, I want a lot more. So, you know, I think, and Henry Abbott has been banging this drum for I don't know how long, but fans always point to this Thunder model as if, you know, first of all, it's a realistic model, and secondly, as if that is the way to win, when for every team that you could say, oh, they just were bad and loaded up on top five, top 10 picks and got good, there's, you know, a dozen teams that did the same thing and just stayed bad forever. And then you flip that and you look, okay, so you look at this Spurs team that we just played. You know, they got Kawhi Leonard in the middle of the first round. They got Tony Parker at the end of the first round. Obviously Manu in the second round, Thiago Splitter in the second round. But once they built a culture of winning, then they were able to develop guys. So to me, you know, even if a guy has infinite more talent and he's taken by the Sacramento Kings with the fourth overall pick, a guy with less talent taken by the Spurs at, you know, 18, I think more times than not is going to turn out to be the better NBA player. And I guess what I'm saying is that everybody just thinks that, you know, all the, you know, the answer is the next 19-year-old. But I think this team needs to start winning. And then even if the picks aren't until 12, 15, 16, 17, 18, I mean, look at the guys that the Hornets lost to this week. You know, I mean, even Danny Granger was a mid first round pick, David West, late middle first round, Paul George at the end of the lottery. I just don't think that this Thunder model is something that's realistic. I would trade that pick today for a guy like Luol Deng and just start winning right now to get that culture in here. And I don't know. I don't see any other way. I don't think whatever 19-year-old is the answer. So not only do I want to win with Eric Gordon, I would really love it if Demps made another move, even if it cost us our number one pick, in order to really snap this culture out of what it is.
So you stole my thunder.
Oh, nice play on words. Thunder.
Right. And that, so I'm going to rattle through these teams really quick so everybody can get this idea. And you brought it up. Everybody points to the Oklahoma City Thunder model, like draft three young players. They'll turn into something amazing. Your world will be perfect then. But let's just rattle through today the teams that are in the playoffs, and we can pick out the teams that actually did that, where they drafted players, developed them in-house, and their best 2 to 3 players were completely acquired that way. So Miami, we know, is not. New York, definitely not. Atlanta, that's the first one where you could say that. They got Horford. They have Josh Smith. Both of those guys were drafted by them. Technically, Joe Johnson was their other big guy, and he's gone. But, you know, if we're just talking about people on that team, right. Those are the two big ones right now.
But again, Josh Smith and Jeff Teague, both guys taken in the second half of the first round.
Correct. Yep.
Okay.
Chicago. Now, Chicago, I would say they built that way. But they got lucky when they got Derrick Rose because they didn't have that bad of a team. But they have Derrick Rose, Joaquin Noah.
Right, but they didn't keep losing after Rose.
True.
So the Hornets have their Rose and Anthony Davis, but Deng was already there and already knew how to win. I mean, he was a key part in a playoff series, you know, in which the Bulls beat the defending champion. So
Right. I mean, they won Derrick Rose when they had like a 1.6% chance of doing it.
Right.
So, I mean, that was ridiculous that they got that lucky. But, right, you could still claim that Chicago built that team that way.
Yeah, and then the piece that kind of started to put them over the top, Taj Gibson, number 24 overall.
Right.
Okay.
Absolutely. Omar Indiana. Peak,
second round. Go ahead.
So now we're talking Indiana. We're doing the same sort of thing here. And Dave West, no. Hibbert, yeah. George, yeah. And Granger, yeah, although Granger's been there a long time. But, again, any of those guys in the top?
No.
Hibbert was, like, what, 15?
18, Granger, yeah. Yeah, Hibbert was in second half of the first round, Granger right in the middle, George at the, you know, towards the end of the lottery.
All right. Then we'll go on to Milwaukee, which Brandon Jennings, Monte Ellis, you know, those are probably a bit too big. I don't even know who else to talk about there. I mean, most of the rest of the contributors who are really seriously contributing, other than Larry Sanders, who's, what, 16th? They didn't build this way. They didn't just build a bunch of three young guys and do it. Brooklyn is clearly not. They bought everything they have except for Brook Lopez. And then Boston, they've brought everybody in from outside except for Paul Pierce. And Pierce has, you know, been there for 15 years, so he's hard to talk about that way. That's the Eastern Conference. We go to the West. L.A. Clippers, they've got Griffin, and that's it. I mean, I guess you could count DeAndre Jordan, but I wouldn't put him in the top five on that team. San Antonio, they got their one big guy, and the rest of the guys they built really late in the draft. Memphis, Zach Randolph came in from outside. Marc Gasol was a trade. They did bring him in, at least. I guess you could make that claim. Tony Allen was out from outside.
Yeah, but, I mean, what's funny about Memphis is they tried to do the Thunder model. They were so poor at drafting. I mean, this is a team that instead of Mayo could have Kevin Love, instead of the Beat could have James Harden. Like, they tried to do it the Thunder way, failed, and then went out and said, okay, let's take a risk in a trade with Zach Randolph. Let's sell an expensive piece for a cheaper piece and develop Marc Gasol. So, yeah, I mean, they tried to do the Thunder way, and if they would have kept going that way, they failed. Instead, they turned it around and said, let's bring some veterans in, you know, to go with these young guys in Connolly and Gay. They brought Tony Allen in, who is the exact type of guy I would want to bring into this team.
Right. And we can keep going. I mean, Golden State, they brought in David Lee from outside. I mean, they did develop Curry and Klay Thompson from inside the group. So I guess you could put them in the classified area of developing from inside. But we keep going through these teams, and it's always but. It's always but. I mean, Oklahoma City is the one, other than Atlanta, that I would say really built out of the draft.
Right. Yeah, and I mean...
Houston's next. Harden was bought from somewhere else. Denver's after that. Other than Ty Lawson, everything comes from outside of there. Portland... Okay, Portland's eighth. I don't expect them to stay there. So Portland, you could say they did it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, so I think you're absolutely right. And, I mean, I will say this. You said you think that the Hornets are further away from being decent than people want to give them credit for. But I really honestly believe that if you could have Anthony Davis, Ryan Anderson, Eric Gordon, and bring in one decent 15 PER or better guard, this team is a playoff team.
Yeah. I mean, what do you think? I mean, what do you think this exact team with Eric Gordon and Luol Deng is?
If they start from the beginning of the season?
Yeah.
I think that they probably will win 45 to 47 games.
Yeah. Yeah, I just I don't know. I think it's more than just whatever we can measure on the court. I think one of our readers put it in a comment last night, and it's so true. Like, who is the leader on this team? Because Eric Gordon's going to come back, and he is going to be the best player on this team if he is, you know, the guy that we saw last year. But is he, you know, he does not strike me, or, you know, has never shown to be any kind of a leader. I think just little things like that, little intangibles, you know, is something that this team is missing. And when you blow huge leads like you do against Indiana, or can't complete the comeback against San Antonio, it's partly got to be because you don't have, you know, those extra intangible things. And I just think a guy who's been through battles before, a locker room guy, a calming presence, you know, and a leader would help this team out so much. And that's not going to happen if the Hornets hold on to this pick and grab another 19, 20-year-old.
Right. And you say, who are the leaders in this team? I honestly believe that the two guys who are in leadership positions are Vasquez and Jason Smith. I think they're the most vocal and the most out there trying to get lead by example and do things. Here's my problem with that. You can get away with a lesser light on your team, a lesser talent being one of the leaders on them, if it's like Derek Fisher and he's got the backing of Shaq and Kobe behind him. If it's somebody who's been through playoff wars and hit big shots and proven things and has the respect of other players. And nothing against Jason Smith or Vasquez, they don't have that respect. They don't command that type of respect. If Grievous Vasquez walked into the Miami Heat locker room, actually, I'll throw that away. If Grievous Vasquez walks into the Phoenix Suns locker room and starts saying stuff, he doesn't command any respect because of his talent level. He doesn't have that ability to look at someone and say, this is how you should do something, and have them say, well, you know what? He's right, because he's really good at basketball. Or he's proven that he's been a big piece of a really good basketball team. They're just going to say, okay. That's the best you get.
Yeah.
You might get some obscenity. So, I mean, it's, I think that is a major problem. And, you know, while you can say Monty might, you know, be that kind of presence, he's not that presence on the floor. And he can't, I mean, you can't make coaches always have to be, oh, well, he should just provide the leadership, or he should provide the awesome play that will make all the worries go away. I mean, at some point, it's the talent and the leadership on the floor that matters.
Yeah. Yeah, and, I mean, talent is a thing. And the other thing I notice, and, I mean, this kind of goes more into the Indiana game, but it's a long, you know, it's a season-long theme of this third quarter just absolutely kills the Hornets. And, you know, at a talent perspective, I mean, if you have one of those guys that could just create his own shot when things are going bad, or, you know, really run a play that's, you know, at the very least going to get himself to the free throw line when another team is on a run, that's, I mean, that's a huge thing that, you know, good teams have. Usually you call them a momentum stopper, whatever you want to call it, but really good teams don't have large runs put on them because they usually have a guy that they could just give the ball to and, you know, go get something easy, whether it's a free throw, a mid-range jump shot. I mean, we saw this perfectly with San Antonio and Tony Parker, and the Hornets don't have that, and that's going to be a big reason why they're going to continue to lose games like they've lost this week.
Right. So we've been dancing around talking about this Pacers game, I think partially because it sucked. So Robin Lopez, okay, MVP. I was about to make something stupid here. Robin Lopez was MVP of the Hornets. Number two MVP for the Hornets, and my take for at least half the game, without any question, was Austin Rivers to me. I thought he was the most impactful Hornet on the floor for half the game.
Gosh, that's scary to say. Yeah.
And you look at his line, 3 of 12. He did nothing in the second half. 3 of 12 for 7 points. And most of his stuff just came in the first quarter, and he was missing those shots. But I still felt he was the most impactful. And it was because he was penetrating. He was, even though he was missing those floaters and the shots off the glass, Robin Lopez had a good 10 points off of cleaning up Austin Rivers' misses because the Pacers had to move to contain the guard who was going to the basket, which let Robin Lopez slide right to the front of the rim for putbacks. So, I mean, if Austin Rivers had continued what he did, I felt, in the first half, which in the second half, this game, I think, would have been entirely different.
Yeah, I mean, and instead they kind of, and this is what was scary and kind of goes back a little bit to what I was just saying, is the end of the game was basically Grievous Vasquez hero ball, and that is just a frightening thought. But yeah, I thought there were a lot of good things in that first half. My MVP of the first quarter was Lance Thomas. I thought he was fantastic on defense. Then in the second quarter, I thought Ryan Anderson really made David West work for everything. The offensive end, West was struggling, was 2 for 9. And then all of a sudden, you know, I don't know what happens, but Anthony Davis is on West the entire second half, even when he's lighting them up. The Hornets don't really make any adjustments. Grievous Vasquez with the ball in his hands. And, you know, quite honestly, I mean, we've seen this for a couple days now. Ryan Anderson just struggling, and, you know, the Hornets struggling to really get him the ball and getting him open looks.
Yeah. Yeah, Ryan Anderson, I think, is wearing down a little bit, but I think that's what happens when you are a secondary scorer stuck into a role of being the primary scorer for game after game. And, I mean, there were some people who were saying stuff like, well, the Hornets weren't running any plays to get Ryan Anderson the ball. Well, the fact is they were running plays to get Ryan Anderson the ball, but Pacers were doing a magnificent job hedging on to him every time. They were, I mean, the guy who was handling the ball was always shading towards Ryan Anderson. If Ryan Anderson ran baseline, they called out switches very smoothly. There is a reason why the Pacers are the number one defense in the league, and it's because they work very well to deny your primary scorer his shooting, his preferred spots. And Ryan Anderson, I mean, like, even the two threes he hit, they were contested. So
yeah, I would like to give the Pacers defense more props, but really, I mean, they do give you that mid-range shot. Vasquez was 6 of 17, but several of those shots were wide open. I mean, he had a breakaway layup that he missed in that game. He had a couple of open jumpers. Brian Roberts, the same thing. And Rivers, a couple of those floaters just going in and out. I mean, to me, this game was so frustrating for the exact reason that the last one was. I just straight up think that the Hornets are a better team, specifically with regard to, you know, this, how these two match up head to head. And I think they should be 2-0 against the Pacers this year. Instead, they're 0-2. And to me, that is just so incredibly frustrating when you see how easy it was for the Hornets to defend them in the first half. And then all of a sudden come out in the third quarter and they just turn the ball over time and time again. The Pacers get a couple easy shots, get some confidence, and then before you know it, it's Pacers lead and the Hornets are trying to come back, and they just couldn't beat this team that I still believe they are so much better than, and this is one of the best matchups in the league for the Hornets.
Yeah.
But
don't have anything else to say about that game.
I mean, at least we got to see Eric Gordon. So I guess a little bit of news. We got to talk to Dell before the game. Some interesting non-Eric Gordon news. We tried again to ask Dell, what exactly was the thinking with the Hakeem Warrick for Matt Carroll trade and buying out Carroll instead of just leaving him on the books and possibly moving him in a trade before February. And he wiggled his way out of that one. So he's a clever guy. So we're still going to try to get that answer for you one way or the other. But the other interesting news was that, Dell Demps let us know that Anthony Davis has grown a half inch since the summer. And I guess they did an MRI on his growth plates or whatever, and there's still room for growth. This guy is continuing to get taller, Ryan.
Yeah. I mean, it wouldn't shock me if he ends up being 7 feet tall. I don't know, is that a major advantage? I mean, his arms are already so long, it doesn't really matter how tall he gets. As long as he can put on some muscle, it doesn't matter to me that much.
Yeah.
Put on some muscle and not have it, cause problems.
Yeah, I mean, at some point, like, people always want their guys to get taller, but I don't know. When I think of tall guys, I think of more injury prone. I mean, I think of how Greg Oden always had problems and Rick Smits and Agakis and Andrew Bynum now. And I mean, Hakeem Olajuwon was, 6'10", maybe, if you're being nice. And he got the job done as a center and did it with craftiness and moves and, with length. So if Anthony Davis grows, that's fine. If he never grows another quarter of an inch, I'll be perfectly happy with that as well.
Yeah. So I do want to bring up, I don't know, for those of you who might not have seen it, it's kind of buried. NOLA.com did have a very, very good article about Eric Gordon. You'll notice we don't say that very often, but this time they did some nice work. So we should bring this up about Eric Gordon. First, I want to say, despite my rampant cynicism about Eric Gordon and whether or not he'll actually really play for the Hornets or not, the idea of Eric Gordon playing for the Hornets is just tremendously exciting for me. It is the perfect Christmas gift. If Eric Gordon comes back and plays the rest of the season, I would be extremely happy. The idea of having a guard to watch, I'll have my 3-point shooter that I love. I'll have my guard to watch that I love. I mean, this is the kind of team that I would like to watch all the time. But so this NOLA.com article about Eric Gordon, and the reasons why he wanted away from the Hornets had to do with the Hornets medical staff saying that he needed microfracture surgery, and every specialist he went to for other opinions saying, no, he just needed rest. And that's part of why he felt like the Hornets may have been just trying to drive down his value. So we've had questions about the Hornets medical staff before. But I mean, what do you take from this story? This is the kind of stuff that happens behind the scenes that you never really hear about or know about. But when you hear about it, kind of makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, so as fans and us as writers and, you know, some of us believed in the conspiracy theory last year that Dell and Monty were actively shutting players down in order to tank, including Eric Gordon. I mean, is it completely far-fetched that they would, I guess, not root for it to be a major injury, but, you know, not having the desire to get a second and third opinion when a doctor would say, hey, this guy's going to be out for the year. He needs this surgery. You know, maybe we could sign Eric Gordon at a cheaper price, plus we'll lose this year. I mean, I guess the surprising thing to me, if this is true, and we got to keep in mind that in this story, they quote an unnamed source, and yep, you have to keep in mind who has something to gain from any story coming out. So you could kind of put two and two together and probably figure out which side the source came from.
Right.
But anyway, I mean, if this is true, even if the Hornets medical staff says, hey, I think this guy needs microfracture, you know, usually the team and the player go out and get second and third opinions on their own just to make sure. So I don't know. I can't believe that the Hornets wouldn't make that part of the process or just try to, you know, force him into microfracture. I think it's a bit of paranoia by Eric Gordon just thinking that, you know, these people have ulterior motives and are trying to take away his money that he thinks he rightfully deserves. I don't know. It's a very strange story, but I don't doubt, you know, its validity, at least from one person's perspective. But I don't know. I mean, the Hornets medical staff just over the years don't have, you know, very much credibility, at least with me. So I don't know.
Here's my one takeaway from this. I have no idea if it's true or not. But what I will say is the communication and the solidarity of any sort between Eric Gordon's camp and the Hornets camp is crap. Everything you hear about them is they're not talking to each other very often. That, you know, one person's in LA and Dell Demps is catching up, Monty's catching up with him. These guys, they don't talk to each other. That screams to me an adversarial relationship. And when you have a free agency intermingled in there, adversarial relationship is going to happen. I mean, when their money enters the scene, it's going to happen. But once that free agency is over, it's got to stop. And both sides should be working to stop it. And it doesn't look like either side are being successful. And I don't know whose fault that is, but Eric Gordon and the team have to get on the same page. They have to, like, at least address some of these issues in such a way that neither of them are going to be bringing up in the media anymore.
Yeah, and if I had to paint it with an optimist brush, what I would say is my feeling is that Eric Gordon, especially after that deadline came and the Hornets didn't re-sign him, I bet he thought he was done with that team and, you know, he wouldn't really have to worry about it anymore. And now I think he realizes that, you know, the Hornets team they're behind him. They obviously gave him the money and, you know, they're willing to make it work. So I'm hoping that it gets better from here on out. And the only reason it was so bad was because, you know, he didn't think he was long from New Orleans. I mean, he has an agent that is somewhat notorious for doing this. Rob Pelinka, for those who don't know, he's the guy who orchestrated that really sketchy deal where Carlos Boozer basically left Cleveland high and dry. He said, you know, let me go and I'll re-sign a long-term contract, let me out of, you know, the team option, I'll re-sign long-term. And then all of a sudden Cleveland does that in good faith and Boozer goes and heads to Utah. Palinka was the guy behind that. He's, you know, somewhat of a sketchy guy. Wouldn't be surprised if he was just telling Gordon, I'm going to get you out of New Orleans, I'll get you somewhere else, don't worry about it, no need for communication here. And now that he's on this team for 4 years, I hope that stops.
All right, so moving on from Eric Gordon, there was one other piece of NBA news I thought might, you know, register on your radar as something, you know, your ears might perk up and your heads go on a swivel and start thinking trade machine.
Chris Douglas Roberts?
Yeah, Chris Douglas Roberts. A lot of people wanted Douglas Roberts, and the Mavs signed him.
Yeah.
You know, hey, more power to them. If they can get Douglas Roberts on the same page with them, fine.
Yeah, no, I mean, Dirk Nowitzki played tonight, but I really think the signing of Chris Douglas Roberts is what's going to bring them back in the playoff chase.
Right. No, I was thinking of your boy, and you even suggested trades for him before, and this can't help but lower his trade value. The Sacramento Kings have banned Cousins indefinitely for conduct detrimental to the team. He will not play for them. And it's no idea how long this will go on. That's, of course, what the definition of indefinitely is, and so I don't know why I'm telling you that. So if you're Dell Demps, is your phone in your hand and you're calling the Kings to see what you can get Cousins for?
I'm probably more likely to be calling a third team and seeing if I could be some kind of facilitator, thinking more along the lines of, you know, Cousins to the Clippers, bring me Eric Bledsoe and let me figure out what pieces I need to give to fill that out for the Clippers or the Kings, you know, whatever. I'm more thinking of those lines. I know it sounds completely weird, but if you look back in the past at kind of these immature players and when it finally clicks for them, there's like a magic age at 27, 28. And it might just be a male age because, frankly, that's when I feel like I finally matured. A lot of my friends finally matured. I think that's more the magic age. I think Cousins is going to disappoint whoever he's with for this contract, disappoint the next contract, and then at the end of the next contract, he's going to get traded and be given up on a lot like a Zach Randolph. I don't think he's there yet. I think he's got a couple of years, but I think whatever team strikes, you know, and goes and gets Cousins when he's 26, 27 years old are going to be rewarded a lot like Memphis, but right now is not the time. But I would definitely be calling around the league, see who is interested, and see if I could some way work in there as a third team and pluck some other pieces out.
Yeah, the only team so far mentioned that still seem interested, and they're both weird. Houston, well, actually, Houston isn't that weird. Houston will be looking at for deals on the cheap, but Detroit, if you have Greg Monroe and Andre Drummond, are you looking for Cousins?
I mean, if you just, you're giving me three big men on rookie scale contracts, I mean, I'm not obliged, you know, and locked into any of them. So yeah, that's fine. I mean, Drummond is a guy that they're bringing on along incredibly slowly. You would have another year with Cousins, but yeah, I mean, they loved Cousins, and probably got lucky with Monroe falling to them, because, you know, they wanted Cousins badly in that draft, got Monroe, and looks like Monroe's at least the more steady guy. But yeah, I mean, work something out in there. Maybe I would be looking for it, but I don't think that's a guy that comes here, helps anytime soon, improves that culture, gives us a leader, all the intangible things we were talking about. He's the exact opposite of that, but I would have an eye on him when he's 25, 26, 27, and I'm going to try to get him for pennies on the dollar at that point.
Yeah, I was thinking about this, and, you know, I mean, the team that seems to make the most sense for me to try to get DeMarcus Cousins in a three-team trade is Celtics. There's just something about the Celtics that I feel like they would think, I don't know if it's true or not, but between Garnett and Doc Rivers, Paul Pierce and Rondo, that they might be able to think they could actually handle Cousins. And they may be right. I mean, going into that particular environment where you're clearly not the man, or even the second man, or the third, might help him. And, you know, if the Hornets could poach someone like Avery Bradley by, you know, throwing Robin Lopez into the deal or something like that, I think that's something that I would be pleased with.
If I still had to predict, I don't think Cousins goes anywhere. People, you know, the Kings, what do the Kings have to lose by holding on to him? They're not going to sell him for pennies on the dollar. I mean, they have nothing to gain. It's not like he has this huge contract that they need to get off their books, as if they could attract a small forward to Sacramento. I mean, a free agent to Sacramento anyway. You know, he's on a rookie scale deal. Even if they eventually lose him for nothing, I mean, compared to what Courtney Lee and Robin Lopez, if I had to bet, I don't think Cousins is going anywhere. And Sacramento's already said as much. I think people think that with an issue like this, they're just going to sell low. But it's not like if they get rid of Cousins, all their problems are solved. So
it's true.
I think he's staying there. But yeah, I mean, it is a interesting situation, and I do still love the guy for going at Sean Elliott. So,
all right. So the Hornets have three games coming up this week, and we're going to talk about all three of them because this is the holiday week, and we are going to be taking the midweek podcast off, so you won't be hearing from us until Sunday. So we get to preview three all winnable games. That's pretty nice. We haven't been able to say that in a while. We haven't been able to say we're certain we would win one game for a while. So I'm going to go out on a limb and predict we win at least one of these games this week. Going out on a limb. I'm actually thinking we'll win two of them. But we're playing Orlando. It's at Orlando day after Christmas. Then Toronto back home on the 28th, followed the next night by a game in Charlotte. So which of these teams you want to preview first?
I want to talk about Orlando.
Okay.
Because
first on the docket.
When we had the Eric Gordon trade extravaganza, one of the guys that I really had targeted as part of a sign and trade in the offseason was Aaron Aflalo. You talked me out of it because you told me how down of a season he was having. And I think this guy's playing fantastic basketball, and I can't believe how good this Orlando team is. I remember looking at this roster and thinking that they were, you know, going to compete with that Charlotte win percentage of last year, and, you know, they're playing close to 500 basketball. They've beaten some really good teams. They've beaten Golden State twice. They've beaten the Lakers this year. You know, they're playing some really solid defense, even though, you know, outside of Aflalo, I don't know who you could say on their team, you know, would be considered even an average defensive player. I mean, they're just really well coached. I don't know how their fan base thinks about it, because I think a big reasoning and rationale for the Dwight Howard trade was that they were going to be so bad that they were going to get a top three pick. And that doesn't look like it's going to be happen. So I don't know how good it is for them long term, but this team is just really interesting to watch right now. You know, playing so hard, led by Aflalo. But I do think that this is an incredibly winnable game, because if you think back to when we played them in Mexico City in the preseason, the guy that the Hornets just didn't have an answer for was Glenn Davis. He was just far too big for Anthony Davis, or any of our, you know, far too quick for Robin Lopez. He was just giving this Hornets frontline nightmares, and he's out for 4 to 6 weeks. So I really think the Hornets caught a break with him out. So I think it's a winnable game.
So you think Aaron Aflalo is the reason why they're winning, though, all these games?
Okay, statistically, partly. Culture-wise, yeah. I mean, I think the guy just plays fantastic on-the-ball defense every night, and I think that this team has kind of adopted his mentality. So when you combine that he's having a pretty good, you know, especially when you think about two guards and how many good ones are in the league, pretty good offensive season, a great defensive season, and then just, you know, infects this team with his hustle and his intangibles every night. Yeah, I mean, he's a guy that I would absolutely love to have on any of my teams.
Yeah, I don't know. I still have the feeling that I think he's a little overpaid. But I don't know. He's definitely, in my opinion, the head of the snake of that defense that they have rolling there, which is very good. But part of it's just the trade that they made netted them a lot of long, athletic, quick players who are not particularly offensively talented. Those players are always underrated and always kind of sneered at. But in certain situations, if you can get like a group of them, like really Philadelphia the past few years has been that kind of player, you know, long, quick, extremely athletic, can, you know, defend really well and disrupt things. And that's kind of what this team is. If you look at, you know, players like Nikola Vucevic, he's actually fairly athletic for a big man. Etuan Moore, Mo Harkless, even Andre Nicholson is fairly athletic. You put Iron Aflalo at the head of that. If you can throw like three or four guys at them at a time, you've got a pretty solid defensive core there. So I don't know. I don't want to like say Aflalo is the reason though, because I think that's overstating his ability. I don't know.
I just think of it from a coach's perspective, and Jack Vaughn comes in first year as a coach, and he has just this collection of guys who, I mean, you look at this roster, and then you go look at the Kings roster, and the Kings, you know, have more talent, more speed, more raw, you know, whatever you want to call it, an inside post presence, yada, 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 and the Magic are just a far better team, and it's because if I'm Jack Vaughn, I could point to Aaron Aflalo and say, look at this guy right here. This is how I want you to play every night. And for any of us who have seen the movie Rudy, you know, that catches on.
Right.
All of us Magic players are going to be throwing their jerseys at Jack Vaughn's door just to get Aaron Aflalo even more minutes where, you know, he's getting close to 36 right now. But yeah, offensively, you know, he's, I know his PER and some of his advanced stats aren't fantastic, but, you know, it's not exactly like he has anybody on this team that makes the game easier for him. He's doing well enough offensively, but I just think his activity, the way he goes about it on the defensive end, hustles, I still think Monty would absolutely kill for a guy like that on this team.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, so you're right. His PER is mediocre at best. But if your PER is 13.6 and you are a top five defender, I mean, you should still be paid a significant amount of money. I still think he's a little overpaid. He got paid a lot, but whatever. I expect that because Glenn Davis will be out, which is really weird to say that too. I mean, doesn't that seem weird to you that Big Baby? We're saying that this game hinges on whether Big Baby plays or not?
I guess, but then when Garnett went down in what was it, 2009, Glenn Davis had, you know, really picked up the slack, was really good, was terrific in the playoff series. I mean, it is a guy who has shown that when given the chance and, you know, when given the ball as at least a top three option on a team, you know, really could find ways to score. It's just, he looks so awkward doing it. He's not a prototypical player. So teams are always looking to move him on for the next guy. And, you know, even I remember when, you know, initially the trade was made, it looked like the Celtics made a killing by getting Brandon Bass and dumping Glenn Davis. And now Bass looks absolutely horrible in Boston. And Glenn Davis was having, you know, a pretty good year before he got injured. So I'm glad specifically matchup wise that he is not in this game, because there is no way that Anthony Davis would have been able to move him and he would have just ran circles around Lopez. So it would have been a tough matchup.
All right. So time to play Name That Guy. So who's that guy?
What a catchy phrase.
Name That Guy. Right.
Name That Guy.
Name That Guy on this team. who's going to come in and light the Hornets up unexpectedly.
I'm going to say, you kind of mentioned it, I'm going to say Andrew Nicholson.
Okay.
I don't know why. I think that they'll put him in the pick and roll, you know, with Lopez or even with Davis kind of catching him cheating from time to time. And I think this is a guy that, you know, hits a handful of mid-range jumpers, and Hornets fans are left going to Wikipedia to figure out who this guy is halfway through the game.
Yeah, I would say J.J. Redick, but people know who that is, so it's not, he can't be that guy. He had a big enough college career that can't call him that guy. So that guy I'm going for is Etuan Moore.
You were
going
to say it. Yeah, 40% three-point shooter. And then another one, he's not that guy because Hornets fans obviously know him, but since Glenn Davis got down, Gustavo's minutes have gone up, and he's been playing fairly well also. So, yeah, they have a lot of kind of that guys on this team. But, yeah, Redick seems to be like once you get around the Eric Bledsoes of the world, when you start to talk about the trade market, J.J. Redick's name seems to be one of the hottest ones out there. A lot of teams really after this guy.
Yeah, and he brings the kind of talents that I kind of would like on the Hornets. I mean, just kind of smart, steady basketball. He can hit the long-range shot pretty well. I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't mind having him in the Hornets, but he is 28, and he's at the end of his contract. So whatever contract you sign next, take him to 32. But how much is he going to be asking for? Because this is like his breakout year. He's, you know, 31 minutes a game. He's scoring 14 a game. I mean, I think he might be asking more than I'd be willing to pay for him at this point.
I mean, but again, that talent is a talent that hangs on for quite a while. I mean, to me, Peja would still be in this league if not for the back. And Redick hasn't had those problems, so...
And it would be nice to have a second competent shooting guard.
I mean, you don't think that J.J. Redick is going to be better than Roger Mason is now at the same age?
Oh, yeah.
Right.
I think he will
be. He'll still be. So, all right. So, talked about the game a little bit. Let's go predictions. I'll let you go first. I'll take the next one first.
Hornets are going to lose by 4.
Yeah, I think... I think it's a little worse than that, but not as bad as the Christmas game at Orlando a couple of years ago that I attended. I think the Hornets lost by close to 50. It was insane. I'd say Orlando by 11. This is a team that, you know, just loves hoisting those three-pointers, and I just think it's another one of those games where we're shaking our head because just absolutely getting murdered from deep. So,
yeah. All right, so next game. This is a team I wanted to talk about because we always talk about this team as and Jose Calderon and how he's like, you know, the guy we want to bring in. And then you start talking recently about trying to poach Kyle Lowry from them. So the Raptors had probably one of the more fortuitous injuries. Andrea Bargnani went down. Andrea Bargnani is one of the worst big men in the entire NBA, in my opinion. Last year, he hit more shots than usual and supposedly suddenly turned into a guy who had some interest in defense. I didn't watch enough Raptors games to be able to say whether that was true or not. But this year, apparently, he's turned back into, you know, cotton candy again. He's not hitting any of his shots. He came out and said the Raptors are the worst team in the NBA. And then he got injured. Bargnani is a 7-foot player who averages 4.3 rebounds a game in 32 minutes. We get upset about Robin Lopez. Andrea Bargnani makes Robin Lopez look like a genius on the boards. But he's not playing for them. And they've actually played better because they inserted Ed Davis. So one of the problems with the Raptors is they're run by Brian Colangelo, who may or may not be one of the worst GMs in the league. I would go with may. And he actually – they've been playing Andrea Bargnani because he was the number one pick in the draft, And then, of course, he was given a huge contract extension. So Colangelo doesn't want to look like an idiot. So he's been playing and making sure that his center gets big minutes. And languishing on the bench was Ed Davis, who had really nice numbers in college and has been playing extremely well since he's started getting minutes again. So I think this team is going to be a lot harder than it was if we had gotten them like a week or two ago. I still think the Hornets will take this game, but at least it'll be fun watching Ed Davis work down low against Anthony Davis, because Ed Davis is a motor guy, and I think that's been a little bit of Anthony Davis's kryptonite, so I want to see how he handles him.
Yeah, I mean, we could say that a big part of their better play is Ed Davis for Bargnani, but it just so happens that was right around the time Kyle Lowry went down and Jose Calderon was inserted. So far this year, the Toronto Raptors are 7-6 when they start Calderon, and they're 2-13 when they start Kyle Lowry. So, and I mean, Lowry's numbers are good. He has a PER over 20. I mean, he's been fantastic. I think he's still a guy that I would love to have on this team, and his individual numbers are stellar this year in a lot of areas. But that's been part of it too. And Lowry should still be out for this game. Calderon will be playing the point. Another interesting guy to talk about is their shooting guard who they took. So they took Terrence Ross at eight overall, just two picks before Rivers. He's putting up about 6 points a game, shooting 40% from the field, 30% from three. Like Rivers, he's not able to hit his free throws, and he was actually a fairly decent free throw shooter in college, so that's somewhat surprising. But that's another guy to watch and kind of see. You know, again, this is a 21-year-old rookie struggling just like they should. There's a lot of interesting pieces to watch on this team, so, you know, I'm going to enjoy watching it, and you're right, enjoy watching it even more since Bargnani's not there to take his 15 inefficient shots a game.
So here's a question for you. Are you watching this game for, you know, you say you're going to enjoy it more because you think the Hornets are going to win, so you're enjoying it, or more because you're eyeballing the players and thinking, I'd like to poach that guy?
I mean, Lowry would be, I mean, if I could have one guy from this roster, it would be Lowry. I like Calderon, but I think Monty would go absolutely berserk with his defense. I just don't think he's a guy that would be, you know, a fit on this team long term. I always wanted to bring him in the short term just to get guys like Anthony Davis easier baskets to kind of, you know, increase their confidence and get them going. But no, not really. I mean, Kyle Lowry is really the only guy who I would want to poach off this roster, and I don't think he's going to be playing.
Okay.
I mean, who would you want? Michael Pietrus, I know, but who else?
So maybe Amir Johnson.
Yeah, I mean, you just talked about a flawless contract. I would be kind of shocked if you would want Amir Johnson and...
I don't think his contract is as bad as that. I mean, obviously, I would also like Ed Davis, but again, I mean, then we're running into fits. The Hornets have some pretty strong front court guys. I'm not really looking to trade for front court guys. So, I mean, one guy I definitely don't want is DeMar DeRozan, and I just have a feeling he's going to light us up for some reason. It always seems to me like whenever I'm like sneering at somebody or like thinking, yeah, that guy's nothing. When we play them, and suddenly he looks like, you know, LeBron James, like Rudy Gay against us, yeah. Torched us. I just never get to, like, sit there and be, ah, oh, yeah, that guy I know, his stats, they're going to suck.
Yeah.
Then they light me up.
Yeah, what I really want to see from this game, I mean, of course I'm rooting for a victory, but what I really want to see is I want to see the Hornets attack in this game, and they'll be at home, and hopefully they don't fall into another one of those third quarter lulls that they've been experienced at home. But this Raptors team fouls at an almost historic rate. I mean, they foul more than anybody else in the NBA. Your guy, Amir Johnson, you know, is the main culprit on this team. He averages over 6 fouls per 36 minutes. You know, Aaron Gray obviously isn't the swiftest of foot either, but this
Kyle Lowry is a big one part of that too.
Yeah, I mean, this team, and especially their bigs, Valanciunas, you know, everybody in that paint area really picks up a lot of fouls. They aren't big threats to send away shots. So I really don't want to see the Hornets settling for mid-range jumpers in this game. I really hope that this is a game that Rivers and maybe even Vasquez could get into the lane and get, you know, easy shots for their bigs or get to the free throw line themselves.
All right, prediction. I'll let you go first this time.
I guess I'm going to stay true to my answers in Hornets beat that are coming out tomorrow. I think this is a game that the Hornets should win. I just don't have a good feeling, so I'm going to say Raptors by 6.
Wow, really?
Yeah, I mean, these home lulls, I don't know what it is, but at home, in almost every game, they have a terrible quarter, and it winds up costing them the game. So,
I guess we should also say this. I'm expecting Eric Gordon to not be available for any of these 3 games. Are you assuming the same thing?
I liked your position. I liked your prediction of, I believe you said, January 2nd.
Yeah.
I like that. I agree that I don't think they should bring him back in his first game for a home game. So, it was really funny when we talked to Dell and one of the other guys said that Eric told him that he expects to be back at the end of the month. And back to your communication thing, Dell was kind of surprised by that. His reaction was, he said that. Well, I'm glad he feels that way. You know, hopefully it's true, but I don't know. So that was Dell's response. But no, I don't see Gordon in this game. I think a better chance of that following night at Charlotte. But why put him in the first game of a back to back? I think if he is ready to play around, then just start him Saturday night at Charlotte.
All right, so.
What was your prediction?
Oh, my prediction? I believe that the Hornets are going to take down Toronto by 12.
Nice. All right.
Of course, my predictions have been really bad recently, so don't anyone gamble on that. So, Charlotte Bobcats. We get to play them next. So, last year, the Charlotte Bobcats were the worst offense and worst defense in the league. They were the worst team of all time, so that's not too surprising. This year, they started off really well. They raced out, and they were like 7-7 at one point, and now they're 7-20. They actually are the only team that's managed a longer losing streak than the Hornets. So it's two teams coming in for a titanic battle to maybe stop two really long losing streaks, if Michael's predictions are right, and the Bobcats match them. And the reason why they've gotten so bad and they have not been able to win, it's because their defense remains the worst in the league. And the Hornets were really, really working hard to have that honor, yet Charlotte worked even harder. So this will be two teams that are not interested in defending anything, apparently, going head-to-head. So, Michael, who do you think is going to out-worst defense the other?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you're right. They were actually 7-5 at one point. They've lost 15 in a row. And then they have Miami and Brooklyn in the two games before us. So they could easily be on a 17-game losing streak when we meet up with them. But, yeah, I don't know. I mean, they're bad in so many areas. They give up great shots, and teams obviously hit them. But then even when teams miss shots, they're horrible on the boards. I mean, they give up more than 30% of the rebounds that the opposition misses. It's all around a poor effort. Even on the rare occasion that they get a team to miss, they give up, you know, the offensive rebound nearly a third of the time. So I think the Hornets could really attack them there. But, you know, like we saw in the first meeting when Ben Gordon went off, they do have some guards that could give our guards who can't defend, who can't stay in front of quick guys, trouble. So it could be one of those situations to where if their perimeter guys are feeling comfortable at home, you know, two or three of those guys could have a decent night against our poorly defending guards.
Yeah, that's true. And I mean, I worry when you have players like Kemba Walker and Ben Gordon out there, because those guys are exactly the kind of guys who just keep shooting and shooting and attacking and attacking and can, you know, hurt the Hornets. The Hornets aren't particularly good at defending them. And they've got Gerald Henderson out there now. He was injured to start the season, and Henderson's not a bad player. And he torched the Hornets last year.
They're almost like the exact inverse of the Hornets. I mean, Kemba Walker with a PER of over 19, Sessions 19, Gordon 17, Henderson 17, Michael Kidd-Gilchrist 17. Like, they have guards and wings that are good NBA players, and then you go to their front line, and it's just abysmal. Like, it's
Byron Mullins 12, Tyrus Thomas 11, Bismack Biyombo 10.
I mean, just to put it this simply, they were so bad up front that they traded for Akeem Warwick as an upgrade. That's as much as I need to say.
Right.
So, I mean, it's really funny. It's two teams that are playing really bad that collectively, as of right now, have 26 game losing streaks between them. And it's just going to honestly be a matter of which strength, you know, could dominate the other weakness. I mean, it's a tough matchup to predict because, you know, it's strength versus weakness in the backcourt, strength versus weakness the other way around in the front court. So, you know, it's really just going to be which one of those two wins their battle by a greater margin.
Right. All right. So I actually feel that the Hornets, though, because of they're the worst. Their defensive rebound rate is 69.7, which is horrible. I can't remember too many teams that are below 70% defensive rebound rates. I have a feeling that the Hornets are going to take advantage of that and they're going to win this game. But I have a feeling it's also going to be a really ugly game where both teams have horrible stretches. And I like we saw that one time, you know, I'm thinking like a 77-75 kind of game where the Hornets managed to win this time. The only thing that I'm worried about is, you know, if it comes down that close, I mean, if I had to make the decision, do I want Kemba Walker or Grievous Vasquez with the hands in their ball at the end of the game? I'd rather have Kemba Walker. So it makes me a little leery to make this call, but Hornets by two.
Yeah, I'm going to go Charlotte by five.
Wow, are you predicting a sweep against us, against these three teams?
Yeah. I mean,
Wow.
I know, I hate it. And I looked at it earlier today again for our Hornets that's going up Monday. I predicted that the next win won't come until that January 5th game at Dallas. So I really hope I'm wrong, but I don't love any of the matchups, even though these teams are all far inferior to what, you know, we've played so far this season. But I don't know how you could have so much confidence in a team that lost 10 games in a row, blew a 22-point lead at home the other night. I mean, to me, they've got to be the underdogs in almost every game regardless. And I really hope they win one or two of these games, but I could easily see an 0-3 week again, unfortunately.
All right. So is there anything else you want to talk about now that you've depressed all of our listeners on Christmas Eve?
No, just I'm really excited about, you know, the possibility of Gordon coming back. Really been diving in to a lot of the numbers about, you know, how it might impact the team. I mean, I guess just from you, I say Eric Gordon's coming back. What's the first thing that comes to your mind as far as a specific area or areas where this team could just drastically improve?
With Eric Gordon on the team?
Yeah, like specifically, not just saying offense, but specifically how you would see that offense being different and who or what would improve within that and at a fairly drastic level.
Well, I mean, right off the bat, free throw rate. I mean, the Hornets are not very good at drawing free throws. They hit them at a high clip, but they don't draw very many of them. And Eric Gordon, he's been an efficient player in the past, and always people always talk about his shooting, his three-point shooting, which is okay. But it's always been his ability to get to the basket. So I think that has two immediate impacts on you. One is you're going to draw more free throws. Two, you're going to get more offensive rebounds. And I think that will help this team tremendously on just their overall efficiency, being able to get those offensive rebounds and putbacks when he does miss those shots, because people have to come over to contest Gordon.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, when I was going through the numbers, so far what's encouraged me the most is when you look at both Eric Gordon's numbers with the ball in his hands, I mean, as a pick-and-roll ball handler and in isolation. But then when I looked at Grievous Vasquez's numbers off the ball, I got really excited because, I mean, he is almost, I mean, it's basically a 40% increase as far as his efficiency when he is playing off the ball or just in straight ISO situations or in the post, whatever, different things that I could see him doing in this offense, not so much the pick and roll. I mean, he's been a terrific spot up shooter by the numbers so far this year. Doesn't turn the ball over, obviously, in those situations. And then you go back to Gordon's pick and roll and isolation numbers from last year, and it's a quantum leap over what Vasquez is doing right now. So if you could replace, and Vasquez, over 40% of his looks come out of the pick and roll. So if you could take that away, give him more spot up looks, and then replace Vasquez's pick and roll with what Gordon was doing, I mean, the numbers say that this could be a top 3 to 5 offense in the NBA just based off of that. And we still don't know how much Eric Gordon helps Ryan Anderson and Anthony Davis getting easy looks at the basket, but just strictly on, you know, taking out Grievous Vasquez, inserting Eric Gordon in those same situations that the Hornets run and giving Vasquez the majority of his shots off the ball or in secondary isolation, I mean, this team just looks like it could be amazing offensively if Gordon could come back and play the way he did last year or the year before.
Right. And, I mean, even if they swing a trade for, if they can swing a trade for a small forward who can knock down a three-point shot, this team, offensively, I don't have any complaints about it, probably.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be, it would, like you said, it would definitely be a good Christmas present. I got to admit that I will also be watching the games with my hands over my eyes because, one, you know, the first time that Eric Gordon goes down and either goes to the bench or takes a trip back to the locker room, like, I'm going to be freaking out until I see him back on the court. But that'll probably always be the issue with him. Maybe eventually, like with David West, you know, we don't have to worry about that anymore. But at the very least, you know, this 10-game winning, this 11-game losing streak has been tough. Would love to see him back and, you know, maybe steal a couple of victories if he does come back at the end of this month, but not banking on it.
All right, so I guess we're finished. Thanks, everybody, for listening to In the Know. Have a happy holiday, and we'll again be back next Sunday.
Introducing Guinness Nitro Cold Brew Coffee Beer, blending the smooth, creamy nitro taste of Guinness with hints of coffee, chocolate, and caramel. Guinness Nitro Cold Brew Coffee Beer, your new favorite part of the day. Look for it where Guinness is sold. Must be 21 and over to purchase. Please enjoy responsibly. Diageo Beer Company, New York, New York.